This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is the 6th of February 2011 here in Japan, and the 5th of February 2011 in America, where I'm joined on the line by Arab-American researcher and journalist Maher Osaran of MyDemocracy.net. And it's a pleasure to have you on the program today. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, James.
All right, well, Maher, it's the first time you've been on the program, so perhaps you can tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
I'm of Lebanese origin. I've been living in the United States since 79. I'm a mechanical engineer with background in metallurgy and process engineering. And I speak French, English, and Arabic, and some Turkish. And been a close observant of Middle East politics since the 70s. That's when Lebanon was going through the civil war, and ever since I've always observed what's going on there.
Okay, and well, I guess today specifically I wanted to have you on to talk about the work that you've done on the Bin Laden confession video from that was released in December 13th of 2001 and that has often been referred to as the Fat Bin Laden video. And I want to talk about that video because I think your work has been extremely important in detailing what that video was really about and what it really showed. And I think it's quite different from what a lot of people have claimed what this video is about. So let's start setting the background towards what this video is, where it came from, and what the official narrative of this video is.
Well, like everybody else, I saw the video on December 13th. And the way it was being built up about this paraplegic guy going to Afghanistan was kind of, that kind of raised the flag, red flag, especially that it was done on November 9th, supposedly. Now, a paraplegic is somebody in a wheelchair going to a country that's going through, you know, carpet bombing. And if he's going by car, a bridge could be bombed. How they are going to transport him from one side of the valley to the other if the bridge is gone. So it would have been like an impossible trip for somebody in a wheelchair. So that kind of like raised the flag that must have happened before the carpet bombing.
That's right. And in fact, another aspect of that is that in the entire video, they don't mention the carpet bombing that is supposedly taking place all around them as they speak.
Correct. That But that was before I even saw the video. Okay, that was in, you know, they were preparing the audience. So, and then when I sat to watch it, once a big flag was raised, then lots of little flags came up. And I suspected that the camera was not a handheld camera back then. But I knew how much work that involved. Tremendous amount of work. And so I contacted some local media in Connecticut, and everybody was like way too busy and way too involved with the aftermath of 9/11 to even like talk to me about the subject. So I kind of let it sit, you know, let go of it because I knew that it was almost, you know, it was too much work. And I joined the peace movement, and I went to all the demonstrations, and I thought maybe our democracy would be a way to, you know, stop the wars or prevent the wars or whatever, especially the Iraq war. And then in late 2004, I called a friend of mine who happens to be the guy who opened the American embassy in Afghanistan to wish him a happy birthday. And the first word out of his mouth was, "How does it feel to be a third-class citizen?" Now, this guy was a hostage in Iran, and he's an American hero. I'm like, you know, if he's telling me I'm a third-class citizen, he must feel like a second-class citizen. But I wanted to hear it from him. And basically, he was complaining about the neocons. I mean, he said, with all the amount of time that I spent in those countries and my knowledge and experience, nobody listens to me. And that's when I said, if, you know, Michael feels that way, it's time for me to start this work. And I started the work, and it took a full year to complete. And I lived on like less than a dollar a day for a year. But the work was done and the material was published, and that was important.
Well, that's incredible. Well, let's set the stage for this and make sure everyone's on the same page, because I'm sure that some people in the listening audience may not remember the video or the details surrounding it. So let's talk a little bit about, so as you mentioned, this was supposedly filmed on November 9th, 2001, as after the American carpet bombing had already begun in the country. And it involves the paraplegic sheikh coming to visit Osama bin Laden, supposedly. Tell people how this video was supposedly discovered and the narrative that the Pentagon put out regarding it.
Well, maybe I can read directly from what Ed has. Well, basically, there were multiple stories about the discovery when it was first discovered. First, it was discovered in Jalalabad, then in Kandahar, and then this. First, you know, they just happened to, you know, they had a tip and they went there. Too many stories, but then there's the official Pentagon statement that it was discovered in a safe house in Jalalabad, and that's basically it.
Right. So okay, it was discovered in a safe house in the entire country. They managed to
A safe house that Al Qaeda used to be in.
Right.
And
so they dug this out of a drawer somewhere, supposedly, and.
Yeah, or it was playing on TV when they walked into the room.
Oh, I see. Wow. Coincidental. Well, so then why did it take 1 month for them to, or however many weeks for them to release the video, supposedly?
Well, my work shows that it was, you know, the timeline is quite different. The video was taped on around September 26th, you know, plus or minus a day. And when they went into a small town in Ghazni province where bin Laden's family lived, that's where the other portions of the tape were, you know, not discovered, but that's when they got their hands on them. And those portions of the tape were sent electronically, probably via satellite, to Washington. Okay, or to the Pentagon or the CIA or whoever. So we have two portions of the tape, one September 26th and one after November 2nd. The September 26th portion has analog anomalies. After November 22nd has digital anomalies. So these two cannot be on the same tape in Jalalabad that they say they discovered in early November. Or mid-November.
Right. So what were those two parts? I mean, what was actually on those two separate parts of the tape?
Okay. The one with the analog anomalies is the one where bin Laden is sitting and discussing 9/11. The one with the digital anomalies are actually home videos of bin Laden's family. And his kids are featured prominently in those videos. Their names are called. Bin Laden's son is playing with the crashed helicopter wreckage. He's playing with the landing gear of the Predator. Okay.
Explain that for people, the Predator.
Okay, well, what we did is we reconstituted the video and put it in the proper timeline. On September 21st, 2001, the paraplegic sheikh left Saudi Arabia. Now, in the tape, the sheikh says that he left in a hurry, and he gave that as a reason for not supplying bin Laden at the meeting with evidence of what the scholars, the Muslim scholars, were thinking. And the only reason bin Laden accepted to see this paraplegic sheikh is because he was worried about the reaction from the Muslim scholars within Saudi Arabia. A Muslim, when he goes to war, he has to more or less give some notice to the other side that he's attacking. And if he doesn't do that, it's un-Islamic. See, so that's why a lot of times before any attacks happened by Al-Qaeda or from Bin Laden, there is a video, and with veiled threats of some sort, just as a warning to be Muslim. Now, he was interested in the reaction, but he wasn't getting it. He wanted to know what the street was thinking, what the scholars were thinking. So that's why he was sold on this visit by this guy. And since he already knew him from past interactions, he accepted to see him. Now, this guy is paraplegic, and he arrived before Bin Laden did. So he had full control over this safe house where they met. Okay, and this, it's a beautiful thing, but it was originally designed. I mean, it doesn't get designed within a week or two. You know, September 21st is only 10 days after 9/11. There isn't enough time to design such a sophisticated sting. It was designed prior to 9/11. So this is what establishes prior knowledge here also of something that's going to happen that's big. So this guy arrives, and in the tape he says, you know, I left in a rush. I'm sorry, I don't have this, I don't have that. He had nothing. Okay? And he was basically, as far as I'm concerned, bullshitting, if I can use this word, Bin Laden. I lost my train of thought here.
So, right. Well, okay. So you're obviously indicating this was a sting operation that was set up. But right. And you say that was planned weeks ahead of this. It was actually before 9/11 that this sting was actually planned.
It needs about 3 months to prepare, to rehearse, to look at all the angles. A sting that sophisticated cannot happen within 10 days.
And if I remember correctly, in one of your articles, you indicated that there was a UPI article from August that had already talked about the sting.
Right. And the UPI article was, it was leaked in Pakistan. So they were probably thinking about using Pakistan as the way to reach Afghanistan. But then they used Iran. And that's also clear in the tape. They got to Iran, and they were met at the border by one of Bin Laden's confidants. He's actually the guy who took care of Bin Laden's kids while Bin Laden was away. He was the surrogate father in a way. And his name is Mukhtar. And he met him at the border, and they took him to the safe house, and they passed through Kabul. Now, by November 9th, Kabul was a wreck. I don't think they could have done that. I mean, that was another flag that they had passed after Kabul. And even the paraplegic in the tape, he says, you know, we expected bombings, and we expected this and expected that, and we got all the way to the safe house without hearing a single shot. So it was... You see what I'm saying?
So the path was paved.
Right. So, I mean, from the Iranian border to reaching the safe house in Ghazni is about 400, 500 miles, if not more.
Right. It wouldn't have happened unless it was allowed to happen.
During the carpet bombing and going through Kabul and all of that.
Right, right. Okay, so who was participating in this sting?
From the tape, we can tell that there are three individuals. One who was a burly man who belonged to like the religious police in Saudi Arabia. He volunteered for the trip so he can carry him around in the deserts of between Iran and Afghanistan, you know, help him out. And another guy who volunteered to stay, for the war effort, for the what's called in Islam as a Muslim, to stay behind and help Bin Laden in the war effort. He wants to become a mujahid, basically. So three people is what we can determine. There might have been a fourth, but I think he does need at least one person as a paraplegic to travel, to get on airplanes and off and all of that stuff. And from the video that was inserted into the confession segment, we can tell that at least we can tell that one person was left behind. Because while he was taping, Mukhtar was also part of the subjects in his taping. And his way of taping was very much not in line with the home video type work that was inserted. It was very random, almost like somebody wandering around aimlessly. So he was there walking around town, just surveying, taping, and somehow his work was also inserted.
All right, well, if this was staged and done in September of 2001, and obviously with the knowledge and complicity of U.S. intelligence as well, then why on earth would they sit on the confession video of the 9/11 mastermind for two and a half months before even thinking of releasing it?
Well, I suspect that they shared it with higher-ups in NATO. They shared it with Blair, Tony Blair. They shared it with Pakistan. I mean, the foreign minister of Pakistan came out and said, I've seen evidence that is basically irrefutable that would indict bin Laden in a court of law. And he said that, and nobody else saw it. I mean, there was nothing to the general public other than his statement. So what did he see? And the only thing that anybody has seen to date is that video. So I suspect he saw the video or a portion of it. NATO declared Article 5, which is like designed to deter the Soviet Union, to get, you know, NATO forces involved in Afghanistan. That's like the most, that's like an act of war for NATO. And they couldn't have done it based on, you know, flimsy evidence. And the only evidence we have is that video. Tony Blair was like almost obsessed with supplying video evidence to the point where he basically, his intelligence services stole an Al Jazeera video that kind of showed that bin Laden is responsible and tried to air it. And but since he stole it from Al Jazeera and Al Jazeera caught it in time, they pulled the rug from under him. So I think it was October 14th, he was trying to release the video, and he went to Parliament and said, I'm sorry, I don't have it. So, I mean, why would he take such a risk? Unless somewhere people, not the general public as much as the ones who went to war, were waiting for the video evidence to come out. And I think based on this video where we see bin Laden come in, we see him discuss 9/11, we see him recite poetry, we see him eat, that tape of bin Laden is 3 hours long. And they had to clean it up before they released it to the general public. They had to take out areas where, you know, you could easily tell it was a covert camera. Like, I mean, I watched 90,000 frames, frame by frame. Okay? And some instances, the guy who's wearing the camera or holding the camera, let's say, if it's not, was telling the other guy to get out of the way or to hush. There are 28 frames early on when bin Laden showed up. The person with the camera was putting a turban on his head. Bin Laden's arrival caught him by surprise. Now, to wrap a turban around your head, you need two hands. So how could he film himself putting a turban on? You see what I'm saying?
Right. It obviously wasn't being held in his hands. So the question is, where was it placed? Yeah.
Right. And I tried to get people to do this, you know, analysis. And I contacted many universities where you know, I know that people have the capability of doing it. But once they hear of the subject, they almost choke. And mostly because their work, because the technology to determine if it's a covert camera or not is also the same technology that's involved in facial recognition in airports. And most of those professors have contracts with, you know, Homeland Security or this or that to do that kind of work. So to do the forensic for something that would show that they are, you know, they were like, they hung up on me. They, you know, basically only one guy from Dartmouth College accepted to do the work, but I couldn't afford it. And that's when we decided to go with, to see what kind of other things can show that this video was manipulated, okay? And that's when we said, okay, let's go with the analog. Well, once we discovered that analog and digital were both present on the same, and there was an exclusion where the confession was analog, the other part was digital, that was enough for us. And that was cheap, inexpensive for any media, you know, even like a small newspaper, to spend the money to confirm. You see? Whereas the other approach is more expensive. It's close to $10,000. This one is about $1,500, $2,500.
So you're saying the fact that the confession part was analog and the other part was digital shows that they were recorded on different devices?
Correct, but still, once we established that there is manipulation, that this tape is being released to support a war, that this tape, I mean, an illegal war, we have to look at the tape as criminal evidence released by the criminal himself. And any manipulation could be intentional to disguise certain things. The camera that that person was wearing is very likely a digital camera. And the intentional copying it in a PAL format without using the proper, they intentionally did that, because nowadays, if it was done, let's say, in 2001, there were already proper compensations to keep the aspect ratio the same. They intentionally did it without the proper compensation in order to disguise. You see what I'm saying?
Right, so, and this is absolutely key, and I'm sure we've probably just lost a lot of the listeners who aren't following this, but it's absolutely key to understand that there was a conversion between PAL and NTSC video formats going on here, and that is precisely why it's now touted as the fat Bin Laden video, and it appears to be a face, there's always an image of a face shown in relation to this video that couldn't be Bin Laden because it's too fat, and this is actually a product of the PAL NTSC conversions that supposedly went on. So please break this down and tell people a little bit more about that.
Well, basically, PAL and NTSC, they use different vertical lines, a different count. And if you don't compensate for that, you lose a certain count. Let's say NTSC uses 600, PAL uses 500. So if you do the conversion without the compensation, 100 lines are taken out, okay, 100 horizontal lines, and that squashes the image. So what we did is we did one conversion back with the proper compensation, and we got Bin Laden, who's exactly the Bin Laden that we know, okay?
Right, thus proving that, or at least amply demonstrating that this the fact that his face looks a bit elongated or a bit stretched out is because of the improper conversion.
Exactly. Right. Improper conversion. And it was intentional by a criminal mind to mask the origin. You see what I'm saying?
Right, so the implication here is they didn't want the source video to be scrutinized too much, so they manipulated the way
and
it was
done. A lot of people, you know, but the other thing is there are other people present There's al-Zawahiri present, there's Abu Ghais present, there is Osama bin Laden's own kids are present. So some people say it's photoshopped or, you know, it's computer generated. I mean, down to computer generating the kids, that's kind of like, and the kids appear, I mean, in maybe 60 frames. And one of the kids hid from bin Laden behind a wall and kind of surprised his father. I mean, you don't computer generate that kind of interaction. Okay. And you see his father leaning and saying, you know, just go home, I'll come see you later. And the kid brimming. I mean, we still, I mean, the kid is a human being who loves his father and he was happy to see him. I mean, you don't computer generate that.
Right. I mean, yes, just to be clear, I think generally this video is represented only by showing bin Laden, but it's important to understand for people who haven't seen the entire video that, yes, there are definitely other people, identifiable people in the room like Zawahiri and like his children. And that, as you say, would be extremely, exceptionally difficult to computer generate the entire thing.
So that's what led us to determine that it was authentic. And
okay, so expanding from that point then, I guess the obvious question is, who was directing or running this sting?
I mean, obviously the ones, Vulliamy in The Guardian or The Observer, same newspaper, one is a Sunday, and they, within a few days of the video, they came out with a report saying that the video is a sting operation run by the CIA with the help of either Saudi or Pakistani. And our work determined that it was Saudi and even Iranian, because the Iranian, the guy went through Iran, and nobody goes through Iran without being scrutinized. So the Iranian intelligence was also helpful. At the time, they were cooperating with the Saudis. They might not have known the end game, but they gave safe passage to this guy. So basically, that's what we were able to confirm, that it was Saudi. And later on November 2nd, when the helicopter went to pick up bin Laden, and there was right at the outskirts of the village, collided with a Predator drone that basically, and at the time, that type of Predator drone was a prototype, and there were two in operations and two on standby, and that was confirmed by the CIA to me. But since they never answered any of my questions, I didn't use what else they told me, which is that the Predator intentionally hit the helicopter to sabotage the mission. I said, well, fine, but I have some questions. You know, could you please answer them? And they refused to answer them. I said, okay, I'm not going to use your stuff, because then you would push my story into the, you know, the conspiracy kind of theory. I do know that there was bad weather, and that could have been a cause. But the fact that the Defense Department told us about these two events as unrelated tells me that there was something more going on there, and that the helicopter was actually going to pick up bin Laden. And the helicopter, by the way, was traveling through sleet and freezing rain. And it was at night, using night vision goggles. The visibility was barely 100 feet. It's almost like driving on a highway with, you know, in a snowstorm at night with your high beams on. That's basically what they were flying through. So for them to take such a risk, it had to be, you know, an extremely important mission. So to me, it was basically the last time they could have grabbed bin Laden. They went for it. It was a Hail Mary, and somehow, you know, they did collide with the Predator, and I think the American government should investigate.
And just to be clear, the CIA told you that the Predator intentionally hit the helicopter that was supposedly going to nab bin Laden.
That's what they told me. But I think an investigation would reveal exactly what happened. I mean, as a prototype, I wouldn't want to send it into, you know, an environment like that because, you know, the Predator is controlled by satellite. And to send it in such weather conditions, you have to have extreme confidence in your satellite communication with that aircraft. So I don't see why they were there at the same altitude as the others either. But the helicopter came out of the USS Roosevelt, and after two helicopters, one was hit by the Predator, it crashed. The second helicopter rescued the people on whoever, you know, they took whatever was there, whether they died or not, we don't know. And an F-14 that also came out of the USS Roosevelt in support of the mission bombed the wreckage of the helicopter to basically clean all evidence. So Admiral Mullen might be a good person to ask, you know, what the heck happened there, because he was in charge of that area.
That's fascinating, and I don't even know how to really wrap my mind around that operation at the moment. I mean, that's just, it's so bizarre, and it's so bizarre that the CIA would tell you that about the Predator.
Well, I already had written the article, and I already knew. So what they were confirming to me, as if they were confirming to me that the sky is blue, I already made my analysis. I already did the research. I determined exactly what Predator model it was, and I knew how many were operation and how many were standby, and that was prototype. That was determined independent of them. Now, they came and confirmed to me that the sky is blue. I said, nice, thank you guys, but you know, if you're giving me this other piece of information that it was intentional, you have to answer some questions. Otherwise, I can't use what you're telling me.
And what questions did you have for them?
I don't recall the exact questions, but it was something that I basically dismissed, that they were trying to manipulate me and to push me into. And so, in my work, there is no leaks. Everything that I write about was based on analysis. So if somebody, and I had enough based on analysis, and I knew these guys were trying to manipulate me more than anything else. So that's why I ignored them. And I probably just said, you have to answer some questions, and they never came back. So I never really formulated the questions, to be honest.
Hmm. Okay, just incredible. So again, just to be clear, that's referring to the wreckage that is filmed in the same video, or is inserted into the same video as the bin Laden confession video, and that's the one that contains the digital artifacts.
Correct.
And then the confession video has the analog artifacts, but you're saying that was because of manipulation, not because of a different actual source for the video.
No, it's a different source of the video, but it was also
digital, right? Okay.
From the digital to the PAL, and in order to conceal how it was generated.
Okay.
Because the public would assume that they were saying that the camera was not covert, it was over, you know. So a handheld camera is more likely to be analog and not digital. But the camera concealed in, let's say, eyeglasses has to be digital.
Mm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So in order to make it appear like it was a handheld camera, they tried to make it appear like it was.
That's probably what they did, right. And, yep.
Okay, well, I guess other aspects of this video that are important and that people often point out, for example, bin Laden is supposedly wearing gold jewelry, is using his right hand when he's left-handed. Can you address some of those points?
Well, first of all, gold jewelry. I worked in metallurgy, and specifically gold and silver metallurgy, in research and development capacity for 7 years. I cannot, from the video, tell if it's gold or silver. Okay, there's something about video camera, anybody who uses a digital camera, there's something called the white balance. And once you don't get it right, certain things get different hues. Okay, so if somebody's saying it's gold, I mean, I don't know where they're coming from. But the fact that they are wearing jewelry, it is Muhammad, the prophet, wore jewelry. And Muslims, especially people like bin Laden, tend to emulate the prophet. So wearing jewelry is not un-Islamic. Okay. And about bin Laden being left-handed, it was a statement by the FBI that he's left-handed. There are videos of bin Laden, so I don't trust anything the FBI says, but there are videos of bin Laden shooting with his left hand, and that's what almost everybody sees because that's what the media is pushing. But there are other older videos of bin Laden writing with his right hand. And bin Laden's son told the story why his father shoots with his left hand. And the reason is when bin Laden was a kid, he was hammering at some steel and shrapnel broke and hit him in his right eye. And he's basically blind in his right eye. So when he shoots, he uses his left eye. But he's not left-handed. And it is also something that's very immaterial because, you can flip a video and have it be left-handed, flip it the other way, be right-handed. I mean, some picture of Obama with his left hand on his heart went viral, while he was, listening to the national anthem. And later, it was a flipped image. But still, it's immaterial. There is a lot more things that are in there. And that are more important than whether he's left-handed or right-handed.
Indeed. So let's get into them. I mean, what points of the video do you want to address specifically?
Well, there are, first of all, I mean, after I finished my work, and there's also Ed Haas, who did tremendous amount of work with sending the Freedom of Information Act request to the FBI.
Right, and just for listeners, let's just let listeners know Ed Haas, of course, of the now-defunct Muckraker Report and now absolutely famous and enshrined forever in the 9/11 Truth Movement is the man who got Rex Toom of the FBI to admit that bin Laden was not wanted because there's no hard evidence linking him to 9/11.
Correct, but that was only the first thing that Ed Haas got out and the Truth Movement, hang on to. But they never really looked at his later work. It was coincidental that when his article about the FBI came out, that's the same time when Counterpunch published my article. So I contacted him. I said, Ed, maybe I have the answer for you. This is why they don't want to authenticate the tape. The tape has never been authenticated. I am the only guy who did such detailed work on the tape. The reason they don't want to authenticate it is because, it will be found out who the source is. Okay, if they want to indict bin Laden in a court of law, they have to show evidence. They have to show chain of custody. They have to show authenticity. They have to show all these things. So that's why they didn't indict him, because they cannot show. You see? So, and kind of as, well, maybe you're right. So we spent a lot of time together, and he was asking me questions about my work, how did I reach this point to that point. So it was a back and forth. And later he went after the Pentagon, after the CIA, after CENTCOM, and basically his latest article was why I cannot support the war in Afghanistan. And he cannot support it because he believes that it was a sting operation that was run by the CIA, and he came to my beliefs. So, and I truly believe that the federal government is nothing but a criminal enterprise. And I live in this country, but I'm not happy about, you know, the government we live under. More than one crime was committed. All of the soldiers that have died in Afghanistan, they are victims as much as the Afghanis are. And if the Afghanistan war did not take place, the Iraq war would not have taken place. So it's really heartbreaking.
Right. So really the bigger perspective, just to get the sort of overall narrative of what's going on here, the bigger perspective of this video and what it means is that the U.S. intelligence did have access, at least through some conduit, to bin Laden in the wake of 9/11. And instead of using that to nab him dead or alive, as supposedly he was wanted, they used it to try to set him up for a sting operation to get him to try to confess to the attacks, which were then used as a basis for, or was going to be used as a basis for, the justification of the Afghan war.
Right. So right there, a crime was committed. Then when the Taliban said to them, give us the evidence, we'll give you bin Laden, they had the evidence. They did not give it to the Taliban because they wanted to go to war. That's another crime under UN law, international law, the Geneva Convention, and all of that. So that's a second crime. They left the guy behind so that when bin Laden comes back to the village to see his family, they would go and nab him. And they tried. Okay? And there was the crash. Now, if the CIA intentionally sabotaged the mission, that's another crime. Now, the video itself is the result of an intelligence operation. Okay? It had to be declassified in order to release to the general public. I mean, and that release by itself is a crime. So there are multiple crimes other than the dead people. I mean, if the soldiers' families get a whiff of this or get their, you know, kind of like, I don't know what they would do.
Because their deaths would obviously then have been absolutely, completely, and not only avoidable, but completely unnecessary unless these crimes had been committed in order to justify the invasion of Afghanistan.
Right.
All right. Another very important point about the video that we have to address is the confession itself, because in the immediate wake of the release of the video, there was a German TV station that did a report trying to dissect the translation that the White House gave, comparing to their own in-house translation. And that report identified, according to the German TV station, every point at which there was Osama claiming responsibility for the attacks. Certain words and things had been inserted which were not in the Arabic version. And just an example of that, they said that when he says we calculated in advance the number of casualties from the enemy, the German TV translator said the word advance was not said, the translation was wrong. At least when we look at the original Arabic, there are no misunderstandings to allow us to read into the original. When he said we had notification since the previous Thursday that the event would take place that day, the word previous was never said, and et cetera, et cetera. There's a long report, which I'll include in the documentation. So what about your own analysis of the translation of this confession?
The translation, I went by the translation from ABC News. I had the translator himself sent me the material. I compared it. My conclusion is bin Laden knew in advance that it was happening. They were expecting it. He did say that, you know, they were thinking that only the area where, you know, the airplanes hit would be damaged. But he, you know, said that, you know, based on my experience, you know, I thought more would happen, but I didn't even think, you know, as big as this.
But does that mean that he had thought about it in advance, or he was thinking about it as he was seeing it? I mean, is that necessarily decidable?
No, it was in advance. It was in advance. I mean, my conclusion is in the least. I mean, I approach this as a legal thing because I'm trying to prove that there's a crime. And let me digress a little bit. This is the only evidence that the American government had prior knowledge and was engaged in an illegal war. This is the only evidence that will stick in a court of law. That's very important. And this is how I approached it. And my conclusion is that he had, in the least, prior knowledge. In the least.
Right. Okay.
That's
so
from the video.
From the video, and you're going on the ABC translation that was provided to you by I think I know the name of the translator, but I forget.
Right.
Off the top of my head.
So did I.
Right. Okay.
I'm not good with names. That's one thing about.
And so that was an ABC translation, but there was also a Pentagon translation. Were they separate?
Right.
Or were
the
they
Pentagon
the same?
Translation. I didn't think much of. A lot of areas were, they said, that they couldn't understand or whatever. It was a translation by committee. So they had to go with the lowest denominator. One was Lebanese, I think one was Egyptian. So they were not versed in the dialect. There is a dialect issue here, too. And the way that certain, once you reach a certain educational level or within Saudi Arabia, the way of speaking changes. So Osama is highly educated, the other guy is highly educated, and they were jumping topics. I mean, I got stuck in a couple of, and I had to have the clarification of the Saudi guy. So, and, this happened over, several days, even reading the translation and listening, and, it's not like I was watching it on TV. No, I was going back and forth and back and forth. So,
for those of us who are hopeless monoglots like myself and don't know, what particular dialect does Bin Laden speak, and what about the other people who were speaking with him?
Well, I mean, they were basically the Saudi dialect. Every country within the Middle East has a dialect. And within, let's say, the Lebanese can fairly understand the Egyptian dialect, because Egypt has a good movie industry, and the Egyptian movies play on TV in Lebanon and in the movie theater. So you tend to understand the Egyptian dialect. It's easy for us as Lebanese to understand the Syrian dialect and the Jordanian dialect. That's the urban dialect. But if you go to the villages in Jordan, you might have difficulties with the way they pronounce certain words, or the way they compose certain phrases. And they would have the same thing with the Lebanese dialect, the same issues. So, for example, some Libyan dialects I could never understand. Some Algerian dialects I could never understand. I have an Algerian friend, I accuse him of not speaking Arabic. But the Saudi dialect is understandable to the Lebanese, but there are certain things that we can miss. And the train of thought also, if the way that they were jumping topics, it's hard for us to follow. And that's where Saudi would be more in tune with the way that they think, with the way they formulate their thoughts. You see what I'm saying? It's not just it's the same language. Some pronunciations of certain words might be different. The way they compose or their trains of thought, the way they approach things might be different.
So sort of structural differences.
Yeah.
Right.
Not the structure of the sentence as much as the translation of the thought.
Mm-hmm. Right. So sort of a cultural difference.
Right. You can say that. Mm-hmm. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yes, I can. All right. Okay. So your conclusion is that the translation, the ABC translation, was correct, and that it's a confession video. So I guess that leads to the obvious question for a lot of people in the audience, especially my listeners, who will not believe that Osama bin Laden really had any part in masterminding the attacks. So what's your position ultimately on the inside jobness or lack thereof of the 9/11 attacks?
Well, I mean, we both have, I mean, if you're saying your audience is the truth movement, we all have the same objectives. Okay, but my objective is to be able to put, you know, to put it in a court of law and have it stick. And this is basically my assessment is the only evidence where the chain of custody, where the responsibility can be determined or can be, you know, say, okay, you, Pentagon, you released this video, you're responsible for it. If you cannot tell us how you got it, you know, go figure it out, find out. Any investigation will establish the chain of custody, how it came about. Whereas, for example, in the collapse of the buildings, okay, the evidence was hauled away. The evidence is in China, in India. God knows where it went. Okay. And to say that certain things were used to demolish the buildings or this or that, I got a sample from here. Well, the chain of custody is not there. I mean, and even an investigation, you know, might not reveal much. And then you'll have to jump through hoops to be able to prove it in a court of law. This is a simpler approach to reach the same end.
That's true. I agree with that. And I think it is important to be absolutely clear about what's legally pursuable and what isn't. But I, from my understanding of the chain of custody, for example, and the samples that are used from the World Trade Center to establish nanothermitic materials and things, the chain of custody is actually established by the U.S. government itself. It's not something that's just been pulled out of a bag somewhere. So,
okay, which is good. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, because that is absolutely a key issue and one that that occurred to me. What is the chain of custody on the samples? But from what I understand, it's actually been authenticated. It comes from an official source, not from someone's sock drawer. So
that's even more. That's good.
Absolutely. All right. Well, but your point is well taken that we have to be looking at what is legally provable and what we could take into a court. Because ultimately, I agree, everyone here has the same objective, which is to make sure that the truth comes out and is people who are held, actually responsible for the wars that we see being waged around us are held responsible for their crimes. And that is absolutely the most important thing.
Right. Two years at $1 a day. That's
yeah.
A lot of.
Well, that's a pretty remarkable way to live, and in the pursuit of uncovering a truth that's obviously uncomfortable for the system. There are so many aspects to this story, and I think we've covered a lot of them, but obviously I'll be putting up links to your articles, both at mydemocracy.net, and also you've written for Counterpunch, and you have provided me with some other articles that I'll post in the documentation, and people, I wholeheartedly encourage people to go and start looking at this and reading those articles for themselves. But are there any other points about the video that you feel we haven't addressed yet?
No, there is one thing that I haven't used in any of my articles, or maybe in one that didn't get a lot of traction, and that's and I will send you a link to that. And it's a fax from the Philippines to Dick Cheney, and in the fax they report to Dick Cheney that they saw the paraplegic sheikh in the company of one CIA and one FBI. On October 15th, 2001, and they suspect that there was money exchanged also. And they observed him for a period of time, the paraplegic sheikh, and in the company of these people. And they named the people. And I will send you a link to it.
Please do. And where did you get this fax?
This fax was released by Leo Wanta, which is a shady kind of character. And he was an ambassador, and he was an intelligence operative during Reagan, and he had a hand in draining the gold from the Russian treasury and the collapse of the Soviet Union and stuff like that. And he basically was trying to score a brownie point with Dick Cheney. And so he sent him this report. And when I tried to contact Leo Wanta, but he was too afraid to talk to me. He wasn't aware. I mean, the day after the video was released, he sent that fax, not knowing what he stumbled on or what he was releasing.
Right. Well, I would caution people to look at Leo Wanta before they take anything he has to say seriously.
So, and that's why I never used it, but it's evidence that was put in the public domain unintentionally. And I think unintentional evidence is where there is a higher value. I'll give you an example. I sent my material to Seymour Hersh. You probably know who he is.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
If you can tell the audience who he is.
Seymour Hersh with The New Yorker, absolutely incredible investigative journalist. He broke My Lai, which was his first big story, and has reported on numerous things of extremely important import since then, including in 2007 or 2008, he broke the story that Cheney had been planning to dress U.S. Marines up as Iranians and put them on PT boats that the U.S. Marines had constructed in order to attack a U.S. vessel, in order to find a way of blaming it on Iran, in order to launch operations against Iran, and other incredible stories. He's a well-respected journalist.
Right, and he is. And so... But I don't know if you've interacted with him, but I've talked to people who've interacted with him. He's quite abrasive. And he read the material, and he's like, where are your sources? Where are your sources? You need sources for this kind of stuff. He said, you know, I don't need sources. It's all there. It's all clear to me. Because nobody will go with it without sources. I said, and I listened to him, like, really, is it dressing me down kind of a thing? Or what's the word? You know, he was really nasty to me.
Right.
But I listened for like 10, 15 minutes, and then I said, Mr. Hersh, I just want to ask you one question. I couldn't talk for 10, 15 minutes. I just want to ask you one question. You're a journalist in Iraq. You were kidnapped. You were held in a room, a dark room, for days on end. You didn't have your watch. Nothing. And, you know, people bring you food, bring you water, and one day the guy brings you a tray and says, here's your dinner. And he closes the door, and you're sitting there eating the dinner. And you hear a kid running around in the hallway say, good morning, Daddy. Is it nighttime or is it daytime? He said, it's daytime. I said, that's the way I've approached this. It's the evidence that is really stupidly, innocently, unintentionally left in that I was able to extract timelines and truth from. And that's basically it.
Right, I see what the point of that story exactly. So it's the unintentional little things that add up to
right.
what the story is
so
really about.
Yeah. Even though Leo Wanta is a shady guy, the fact that, you know, he observed, or his minions observed over a period of time, this person, the way they worded it, they approached the FBI, you know, and the CIA guys and got introduced to the guy. So they were very close to him. Okay, and the FBI told him his name is Datu bin Abu, which is a name they totally invented. You see, they didn't give his real name, but his image is there, and they recognized it. So it is another. I mean, it fits. You know, the rest of the puzzle, and this is basically how I work. It's almost like a jigsaw puzzle, and you just piece it together, and then when you get the full picture and the clear narrative, then I think you got to the truth.
Well, it is an incredible story, and one that that people really need to look into, because it unravels a lot of threads that go in very interesting directions. So again, I encourage people to use the documentation links to go and read the articles that you've written and others have written on this subject. And again, I don't know, I don't think there's a way to bring a conversation like this to a conclusion per se, but I guess just moving topics, obviously you've done incredible work on this particular video. How about any of the other Bin Laden videos? Have you done any research into those?
I had no interest in working on any other video. My goal is to prove a crime, and I think I've done that, or I've at least... laid the ground, gave a timeline, gave anybody who wants to investigate the crime a way to do it. And I've given all the material to Patrick Fitzgerald. You know, as I was generating it, I was sending it to him. The material was sent to the Judiciary Committee, House and Senate. I'm not shy about my work. I had a very powerful Arab American contact, Conyers, and Conyers, while he was the head of the Judiciary Committee, looked at the material and told the Arab American Arab leader, you know, we'll investigate, you know, in time. So he's aware of it. So that's why when I say it's a criminal enterprise, is because nothing has happened.
What about other work that you have or will be working on in the future? I notice MyDemocracy.net really doesn't seem to have been updated for years now.
Right. I've written other things, like mostly geopolitical analysis, and that were published online. There is a piece, Obama, America's Second Chance, or is it its last? I'll send you a link to it. I've written a piece about Annapolis, the peace conference there. This is basically my background, is geopolitical analysis, or if I am to write about something, I'd write about that. But I only write when I see that something is not addressed properly. I might write something about it, but I'm not really a journalist. I don't have a big audience, and it takes a lot of effort. And so would I write again? The answer is yes. When? Very soon, because I'm planning, I have a little project. But am I a writer, or do I have the ambition to be a journalist? No, I'd rather be an engineer. I'd rather work on clean energy or, metallurgy or things of that nature. That's where my heart is. And if I did this, I did it because I had to, not because I wanted to.
All right. Well, I think that's a good point for leaving off this conversation. So, Maher Asaran of MyDemocracy.net, it's been a pleasure having you on. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, and best of luck.